here tonight because I believe that elective abortion is the defining moral issue of our day. I don't think it's just another issue. I think it is the defining moral issue of our day. The numbers alone bear witness to that. We are witness to approximately 2,500 children who die by legalized abortion every day in the United States, about 900,000 to a million every year in the United States. And if we were instead witness to 2,500 deaths of toddlers, we would certainly see a different response from the church in America, wouldn't we? At least I would like to think that we would see a different response. The fact that the church at large has been so silent when it comes to speaking up for the unborn is a great burden of mine, and I trust you're here tonight because you feel the same. On that note, I want to thank Pastor Bob and the leadership here at Cornerstone Baptist for the fact that they do not shrink back from the difficult, from the tough issues. I think where a pastor stands on the issue of abortion tells us a lot about where he stands on everything else. It also says a lot about his love for Christ, his love for his flock. So, Pastor Bob, thank you very much. And to the rest of the leaders, the pastoral staff, and the elders here, I'm just grateful to be with you tonight. Again, I think this is the defining moral issue of our time, and I think that Christ would have us do something about it. And at the very least, we are to be a voice for those who have no voice. The scriptures are very clear throughout the Old and New Testament. But one passage would be Proverbs chapter 31, verse 8. It says that we are to speak up for those who have no voice, for all who are destitute. And so certainly that includes the unborn. So I know that this is a difficult subject and a sensitive subject for the church to address. I recognize that even here tonight, I am probably speaking to some who have had abortions or have been responsible for abortion decisions. And I think that's the reason this subject should be approached with grace and compassion, something I intend to do tonight. But that is not a reason for the church to go silent, as so many churches have done. Because if the church remains silent, more babies will die, and more mothers and fathers will be plagued with a lifetime of guilt and regret, potentially. So again, I'm just so thankful to be with you tonight, to be with like-minded individuals, to be in a church that cares about the things, and in this case, the people that Christ cares about. We oftentimes hear that, you know, people are just tired of hearing about abortion. You know, we've had legalized abortion for 45 years. Roe v. Wade's been around since 1973. It's now become law of the land. It's time for us to just get over it and accept the fact that legalized abortion is here to stay. Well, I would take great exception to that thought, but particularly the idea that people are tired of hearing about abortion. The reality is people want to talk about abortion. I don't believe everybody wants to talk about it, but a lot of people do want to talk about abortion, but they don't want to talk about it with bullies, and they don't want to talk about it with people who are ignorant. They want to talk about it with people who are compassionate and informed, people who are gracious and who have a compelling case to be made. And that's what I want to do today, tonight, is I want to take this 2 hours, and I want to equip you to speak confidently and to speak graciously and persuasively to the defining moral issue of our day. So that's what we're going to do. I'm going to help you make the case for life by appealing to the science of human embryology to show that from the earliest stages of development, the preborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. And then we're going to appeal to philosophy, which I know is going to scare some of you, okay? But this is not New Age philosophy, okay? This isn't anything weird. But we're going to appeal to philosophy to make the case that there's no moral difference between the adult you are today or the young person that you are today and the embryo that you once were that would justify killing you in that earlier stage of your development, but not now. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to move very rapidly tonight. Everywhere I go, people complain that I talk too fast. It's not true. It's that they listen too slow. So you're going to have to buckle up tight because we really are. We're going to move very, very rapidly here tonight. You should have gotten, when you came in tonight, a handout. I had one up here. Anyway, you should have gotten a handout. It's just a one-page, two-sided. That's all right. You should have that. If you don't have it, would you raise your hand, and we'll see if somebody can get those to you. We've got a couple back here. Can somebody run some up here? I want to make sure everybody's got a handout. You're going to be able to follow this very easily tonight because everywhere you see a fill-in-the-blank on the handout, the corresponding words will appear underlined and I think in yellow, if I remember correctly, on the screen. So it'll be really easy to follow. But if you have any trouble following, fear not. We are going to suspend ethics for the night. You can cheat off your neighbor, okay, just for the evening. And anyway, feel free to do that. We are going to have a Q&A time. It'll be short. It'll be brief. But we're going to have a Q&A time toward the end. So if you've got questions or comments you want to make, we'll give you the opportunity to do that. All right, real quickly, just as a personal note here, I was on the other side of this issue. I did not grow up in a home where my parents believed that abortion was okay, but I sort of defaulted to a so-called pro-choice position late in my high school years and then early into my adult years. But what happened to me was I grew up here. I live in Ohio now, but I grew up in Warren, not far from here. And I came to faith in Christ when I was 21 years old. In fact, it was September the 10th, 1983. It was a Saturday night. Anybody need a handout? Okay, we got a couple there. Raise your hands if you need a handout. We'll make sure you get that. Okay. So what happened to me was on September 10th of 1983, I came to faith in Christ. And it was a Saturday night. The very next morning, I was in church for the first time as a Christian, as a new believer. About 8 months into, that was a church in Royal Oak, and about 8 months into my newfound faith, I walked into the church on a Wednesday night, and I walked out an hour later forever changed. And the reason is because the pastor there showed the movie, The Silent Scream. It had just come out. It was it had gotten a lot of attention in evangelical and Catholic communities, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I couldn't believe what I saw. Little boys and girls dismembered in the name of choice. I remember walking out. It was the basement of the church parsonage that this was shown in, and they had a walkout stairwell. And I will never forget walking out and leaning against the railing and saying, God, forgive me that I ever thought this was okay. So that little did I know that that night, that video would change my life. I pastored churches for 23 years. I loved being a pastor. I didn't leave burned out, bummed out, or pushed out. I left with a burden because I think the evangelical and Catholic communities, the Protestant and Catholic communities, are largely asleep at the wheel when it comes to the subject of abortion. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity that God has given me to do this work. And again, I'm just so grateful that you have invested your evening in this. Very quickly, what we're going to do here tonight is we're going to help you make the case for life. And one of the benefits to doing that is that the more you know about the subject, the more engaged you're going to be in conversation about it. It's just like anything else. If you know your subject, you're going to speak up. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to focus on equipping you. And I'm sure many of you are already very well equipped. Hopefully we'll just spur you on a little further in that. But it does take the pressure off, and it allows our conversations to go more naturally when we know what it is that we're talking about. So I want to start here with a quote from a verse from 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. This is kind of the classical apologetics verse. And here Peter writes to the church and says, always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And then he says, but do this with gentleness and respect. Now, to be fair here, Peter's not talking about pro-life apologetics. He's really talking about defending the gospel. But I don't think we do any damage to the context of this verse to broaden the application to our battle as Christians for the unborn, for life. So he says we should always be prepared to give an answer. Now, I've got that word answer underlined because that's the word that we translate, it's the Greek word apologia. We translate it into the word answer or defense. But this is also where the word apologetics comes from. And apologetics doesn't mean I'm sorry. It means a defense or an argument. So it's very fair to say that if you're a follower of Christ tonight, God has called you to be an arguer. Now, I don't mean that he's called you to be argumentative. The Bible clearly condemns that. But we're to be arguers in the classical sense of the word, in a way an attorney would argue on behalf of a client in a court of law. We present good reasons to believe what it is that we believe because we're doing what everybody else is doing. We're trying to persuade men and women, okay? Now, Peter goes on to say that we're to do this with gentleness and respect. And I'm sure that I don't need to say this, but I'm going to anyway tonight. I've discovered in my work on university campuses, high school campuses, and wherever I go, that if I'm gracious with my pro-choice opponent, if I'm a good listener, if I don't run them over, if I don't misrepresent their view, if I'm humble enough to say, you know, you've made a good point, I'll have to think about that. If I'm willing to do these things, I've discovered that even my most hostile, ardent opponent will usually, not always, but we'll usually calm down to the point where we can have a meaningful dialogue. So this is ultimately about persuasion, okay? It's about dialogue, not monologue, okay? So you don't look like a very angry crowd. Nobody's frothing at the mouth here tonight, so I don't think I need to sermonize you too much. But it's not just that we have to have good arguments. We have to deliver those arguments in a gracious way, in a kind-spirited way. And so that's the Christ-like way. That's what we want to do. Okay, here's a little quote that I like by the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who said this. He said, I attack ideas, I don't attack people. And some very good people have some very bad ideas. And if you can't separate the two, you got to get another day job. I think that is so well said. Now, there are people on the other side of this issue who are, relatively speaking, good people. They make good neighbors, good friends. Some of your family members, some of your closest friends maybe hold to a so-called pro-choice position. What I don't want to do tonight is vilify them or demonize them. That's not my intent here tonight at all. Now, that said, what I do want to do is I want to tear into their worldview. I want to destroy it. I want to drag it out into light and embarrass it tonight. I want to shame it. I want to completely demolish it. If that sounds harsh, I'm getting my marching orders from 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 5, where Paul writes to the church and says that we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. We take it captive unto Christ. So we've got to find a way, and it's not hard to do, to destroy the argument without destroying the person who's making the argument. And it's really not that difficult. If we live as Christ would call us to live, if we are led by God's Spirit, if we are people of prayer, and if we have a love for people who don't know the gospel or maybe are confused on the abortion issue, it's really not that difficult to do. Here's another one, real quickly. Ravi Zacharias, I'm sure a name many of you are familiar with, one of my favorite Christian speakers and apologists, he said this, a little maxim. He said, never answer a question, always answer a questioner. Now, you know what he means by that. What he means is that behind every challenge that we face in our Christian lives, and in this particular case, with regard to the pro-life battle that we fight, there are real people with real hurts and pains. So as an example, I oftentimes speak in high schools and we'll do assemblies, and students will be able to come up afterwards and ask questions. And I can tell you that almost every time, one of the first questions I'm going to get, if not the first question, is, okay, but what about in the case of rape? Now, we've got a really good response to that. We'll get to that at the very end of our night here tonight. But what I've got to assume is that the young lady who's asking this question has been raped. Or the young man who's asking the question has a loved one who's been raped. Now, it's not that I necessarily think that that's the case, but that's a safe assumption, a safe operating assumption. Because I don't want to just give a sound apologetic answer and ignore the fact that somebody might be really hurting here. So again, you don't look very angry. You look like a pretty sweet crowd here, okay? But it just needs to be said that we need to recognize that real people are confused. They're hurt, they are damaged, they are in rebellion, whatever the case may be, but we are Christ's ambassadors according to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. So, all right, let's move on. I want to start tonight here with a pro-life syllogism. And if you don't know what a syllogism is, it's simply an argument. Very simply, here is our argument. Number one, first premise, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Now, almost nobody with an operating conscience, in fact, nobody with an operating conscience would disagree with that statement. It is wrong to intentionally, unjustly kill an innocent human being. Here's the second premise. Elective abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Now, that's where we're going to build our house tonight, isn't it? That's what we are debating, that second premise. Now, if the first one seems intuitively obvious to most people, and if the second one, if we can make a good case for the second premise, then the third, the conclusion here follows. Therefore, elective abortion is wrong and should be illegal, meaning that every human being at every stage of their life should be legally protected. Okay? So that's the syllogism. And when you're dialoguing with people or debating people, I'm not afraid of the word debating. This is what we're doing, okay? When we're dialoguing or debating people over the issue of abortion, you want to get everything off the table, everything that clouds this syllogism. You want to stay focused on this. This will become more obvious here as I move on. Let's do that. We're going to deal with two primary questions tonight. This is the first one. What are the preborn? What are they? This is the million-dollar question. And this is the question that those on the other side of the issue typically want to assume an answer for that they haven't actually argued for. That's called begging the question, when you assume the very thing you actually need to prove, right? So typically, those on the other side don't want to deal with this question. They want to assume an answer to it that they haven't actually argued for. They want to sweep this under the rug, gloss over it. You need to stay focused on this question like a laser beam. This will keep you out of the weeds because they're going to bring up all kinds of red herrings and all kinds of, you know, they're going to want to take you down a million bunny trails. Stay focused on this question. What are the preborn? Now, I'm going to show you a short video, a minute and a half, 2 minutes long at the most. This is Cecile Richards, the former president of Planned Parenthood. I think her tenure just ended here at the end of May. She has resigned or retired from that. But Cecile Richards is an attractive, very articulate woman. She has been an incredibly effective spokesperson for the nation's leading abortion business, Planned Parenthood, unfortunately. And she's on a TV show here. This is the clip I'm going to show you, a TV show where she's being interviewed by, the TV show is called Fusion. I'm sure some of you have seen it. And the talking head on the show is a man named Jorge Ramos, who's interviewing her. And he's asking this question, what are the preborn? Now, he asks it using different words. The way he words it is, for you, when does human life begin? But he's asking basically the same question. But I want you to turn your baloney detector up to 3.6, and you are going to see all kinds of things wrong with this. Okay? But the primary thing I want you to focus in on is this. Watch how much she doesn't want to answer this question, and then I'll make a comment about it. Here it is.
For you, when does life start? When does a human being become a human being?
This is a question that I think will be debated through the centuries, and people come down to very different points of view.
But for you, what's that point?
It is not something that I feel like is really part of this conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, we work with women. I guess the way I'd really like to I think every woman has to make her own decision. What we do at Planned Parenthood is make sure that women have all their options for health care, mm-hmm. and that they have the option to have a healthy pregnancy. They have an option to put a child up for adoption if they decide to carry a pregnancy to term, or they have the right to make a decision to terminate a pregnancy.
But why would it be so controversial to say, for you to say, when do you think life starts?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's controversial. I don't know that it's really relevant to the conversation. But I mean, okay. For me, I'm a mother of three children. For me, life began when I delivered them. They were part of. They've been probably the most important thing in my life ever since. Mm-hmm. But that was my own personal. That's my own personal decision.
Okay. She didn't want to answer the question, did she? But she did answer it. And what was her answer? When does human life begin? At birth. But did you notice how she answered that? She qualified her answer. She said, for me, life began at birth. She's the poster child for moral relativism. Okay? When one person gets to decide if another person matters or not, thereby whether or not they live. And in a sense, that's exactly what Roe v. Wade and Doe versus Bolton did. Those two Supreme Court decisions reached on January 22nd of 1973 collectively brought us abortion on demand. But what they did, those two cases, what they did was they gave one class of our citizenry, namely mothers, pregnant mothers, the right to define another class of our citizenry right out of existence, namely their unborn children, their offspring. Okay? This, you see the moral relativism woven throughout this entire debate, the abortion debate, all right? But the thing that I really want to hone in on here is when the nation's, again, she's retired now at least from Planned Parenthood, but when the former president of the nation's leading abortion provider doesn't want to answer the question, that should tell you just how valuable that question is to us, okay? You're going to see even more as we go along just how valuable this is, all right? Greg Kokel says it this way. He says, if the unborn are not human, no justification for elective abortion is necessary. But if the unborn are human, no justification for elective abortion is adequate. Now, he's nailing it. Now, she said, well, look, I don't know that that's relevant to the conversation. She couldn't be more wrong. Any objective thinking person, regardless of what side of the issue they're on, would have to acknowledge this is really the issue. In fact, Justice Harry Blackmun, writing for the majority opinion of Roe v. Wade back in 1973, admitted that if personhood could be established in the unborn, that Roe would collapse in on itself because the unborn then would be protected by the 14th Amendment. So he even acknowledged that the argument really rests on what are the preborn? Now, I've raised the question. Let me answer it for us here tonight. If you're filling in your outline, this is kind of where you'll want to kind of engage here. You'll see the yellow words underlined, or you're filling the blanks, okay? So here's the answer, and we're going to appeal to the science of human embryology for our answer. From the earliest stages of development, the preborn are distinct living and whole human beings. Distinct living and whole human beings. Now, I want to take those three words that are underlined for you there, I want to break them down briefly here for us, okay? We're going to do some fifth, sixth grade level human embryology. Don't be insulted by that, but it's important for us to lay an important foundation here, okay? So by distinct, I mean that you, and we're going to use you as a working illustration here tonight, from the moment that you were conceived in your mother's womb, by the way, most of you were not conceived in your mother's wombs. Most of you were conceived in one of your mother's fallopian tubes. That's typically where pregnancy begins. And then at about day 6 or 7, you travel down her fallopian tube into her uterus and attach to her uterine lining. But I'm going to say womb because that's kind of in our lexicon, okay? So from the moment that you were conceived in your mother's womb, you were a distinct individual. And what I mean by that is that you were a separate person from your mother, okay? You had a new, distinct human life begins at conception. This is the consensus of human embryologists. Ward Kischer, one example, and I've got a dozen here with me. If you're interested afterwards, I can share these with you. But here's one example. He said this. This is a PhD human embryologist at the University of Arizona. He said, every human embryologist in the world knows that the life of the new individual human being begins at fertilization. It is scientific fact. This is not debated in academic circles. It really is a settled issue in the scientific community. Stephanie Gray, who's with, well, she was with the Center for Bioethical Reform in Canada, but she's out on her own now, but she's a pro-life apologist from Canada. Very, very sharp lady. And she says it this way. She said, look, when the IVF specialist in the IVF lab is trying to create life in a petri dish, they know when life begins. And then she goes on to say, horse breeders know when life begins. Okay? This is a settled issue in the scientific community. So at conception, the preborn has his or her own unique DNA, can have a different blood type, a different race, and a different gender. In fact, if you're here tonight as a man, you had a different gender. So when you hear my body, my choice, you see how silly that is. That would mean that your mother, when she was pregnant with you, if you're a man, had four arms, four legs, and male genitalia. That's pretty weird, right? Okay, so clearly you are a distinct living and whole human being. You had your own DNA, your own blood type, and so forth. All right. Not only were you distinct, but you were living. And all I mean by this is that you were alive and growing. That the things that define living organisms were present in you at that single cell zygote stage. Things like you were metabolizing food for energy. You were growing through cellular reproduction as one cell became two, at least, okay? Thirdly, you were responding to stimuli, and all that means is that you were responding to the environment that you were in. Initially, probably the fallopian tube, and then later, the womb. You were responding involuntarily, of course, but nonetheless, you were responding to the environment that you were in. So you were distinct, you were living. Thirdly, you were whole. And I don't mean that you were mature, obviously, but that you were complete. That genetically speaking, everything that you needed to develop into the young person or the adult that you are today was present in you at that earliest stage of your development. So this is where people in our culture get very confused about this, even in the body of Christ, where people tend to see human beings developing in the womb the same way we would see a car put together on an assembly line. The car is put together on an assembly line by outside influences, namely other human beings that put it together piece by piece, right? Piece upon piece. But with human beings or any living organism, we develop from within. So in other words, from the moment that you were conceived, you were in the driver's seat determining your own growth and development. Now, I'm not suggesting that you were doing that apart from your mother's help. You needed her nutrients, her blood, her oxygen, the protection of her womb, and so forth. But genetically speaking, you were in the driver's seat. Okay, so you were developing from within and according to your own nature. So therefore, the preborn are not parts of the woman's body, as we hear from those on the other side. They are rather whole human beings capable of directing their own internal growth and development. Randy Elkhorn, again, a name I'm sure many of you are familiar with, says it this way, and I think this is just a great statement. He said, something non-human doesn't become human by getting older and bigger. Whatever is human from the beginning. So this might be even new to some of you here tonight, so pay close attention to this point. When you were conceived in your mother's womb, you did not start out as one kind of a thing, and then slowly over 9 months morphed into a human being. That's not how it works at all. Scientifically, you started out as a whole human being, and you grew and developed within and according to that nature. In other words, you changed in a myriad of ways, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. But your nature didn't change. You changed according to your nature, but your nature didn't change. Everything you needed was there, okay? By the way, you're still developing. I don't care how old you are in here. The oldest person in this room is still developing. We develop throughout our lives. From the moment we are conceived, we begin to gain and lose parts. And we gain and lose parts throughout our life. Now, the older we get, the more parts we lose and the fewer parts we gain, okay? But we gain and lose parts throughout our entire life. So we're always developing, okay? So remember what Randy Elkhorn said. Something non-human doesn't become human by getting older and bigger. Whatever is human from the beginning, all right? Now, by the way, it's not just that this is the consensus among human embryologists. But this is actually, to this point, what I've shared is believed even by many, many prominent pro-choice, so-called pro-choice philosophers like Peter Singer, David Boonin, Mary Elizabeth Williams, the late Christopher Hitchens, and many, many others are quick to acknowledge the humanity of the unborn child at that earliest stage of development, okay? Here's one example. Peter Singer, this was that quote I didn't realize I had on the screen there for you. Randy Alcorn, something non-human doesn't become human by getting older and bigger. Whatever is human from the beginning. But let me share this quote. This is Peter Singer. Some of you will know that name, I'm sure. He's the radical ethicist. He's the chairman of the ethics department at Princeton University. And in his book, Practical Ethics, though, he's a staunch defender of not only abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, but of infanticide. He thinks that mothers and fathers, parents ought to have a right to kill their infant children up to 1 month after birth. He says that children that are born with severe fetal abnormality should be put to death on the spot. Okay, so this guy's a radical defender of not only abortion, but of infanticide. But listen to what he admits. He acknowledges, he says, it is possible to give human being a precise meaning. There is no doubt that from the first moments of its existence, an embryo conceived from human sperm and eggs is a human being. Now, if you're not a buyer, if you're sitting there going, this is hard to believe. This is some biased pro-life Christian guy. I'm not buying this. Well, go home and Google it, okay? But let me help you out here if that's you, if you're skeptical on this. Think of it this way. We oftentimes hear, even Christians, even pro-lifers who are well-intended, this is not done with malice necessarily, okay? But in fact, if I were to ask for a show of hands, I'm guessing many of your hands would go up. Mine would, because I used to say this. People will refer to the little girl or the little boy at that earliest stage of development as a fertilized egg, right? You've all heard that. Now, I won't ask for a show of hands, but I'm guessing many of you have used that phrase. Now, I'm going to let you in on a little science. There is no such thing in the science of human embryology as a fertilized egg. There is such a thing as the process of fertilization, where the sperm and the egg or the ovum of a woman, the sperm of a man come together and fertilization takes place. But once fertilization has taken place, you don't have an egg anymore. You see, the egg has died to itself and given its constituents over to a new entity. So has the sperm. Both the egg and the sperm have died to themselves, have given themselves over to a new entity, namely you or a little girl or a little boy. So if that still isn't compelling, think of it this way. Why are we so quick, I don't mean you necessarily, but why are we in our culture so quick to refer to little girls and boys as fertilized eggs, but we would never refer to them as a modified sperm? What would be the difference? What's the difference between a fertilized egg and a modified sperm? There's no such thing as a fertilized egg in the science of human embryology. You were you from the beginning. Okay? So, all right, let me move on here. I quoted Peter Singer acknowledging the humanity. I'm going to jump several steps ahead here, and I want to share another quote with you. This is not on the screen, but I want to read this for you. Warren Hearn is a renowned abortionist here in the United States, okay? Listen to what he said. Quote, "We've reached a point in this particular technology," he's referring to D&E or dilation and extraction abortion, which is a very common abortion procedure where the baby is dismembered, okay? He said, "We've reached a point in this particular technology where there is no possibility of denying an act of destruction. It is before one's eyes. The sensations of dismemberment flow through the forceps like an electric current." This is an abortionist saying this. He's not denying the humanity of the unborn child. He's quick to concede it. He's not alone. Dr. Curtis Boyd, another abortionist, you can see this on YouTube, where he's asked about his grisly abortion procedure, and he says, "Am I killing? Yes, I know I am. I am doing that." He acknowledges it. So again, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that nobody disagrees with this, that nobody in the scientific community or that nobody in the so-called pro-choice philosophy camp disagrees with. Some do. Let me share with you a short video. This is about a two-minute video. Dr. Willie Parker, up until 8, 9, 10 months ago, he was relatively unknown in the United States. He's an abortionist. But several months ago, he came out with a book, and it was titled, get this, it was titled Life's Work, subtitled A Moral Argument for Choice. Okay? Talk about euphemism. The whole book was euphemisms, all right? Dr. Willie Parker, in the book, said that he has performed about 10,000 abortions over the last 15 years. He believes that Christ has called him to this work, and he appeals to the parable of the Good Samaritan for his biblical justification, that this is what God has called him to do. But in the book, he does something that's, or I'm sorry, not in the book, in the video that I'm going to show you, he does something that's very tricky, and I want you to watch this. Turn your baloney detector up to about 6.8, now, okay? And you'll see some things wrong with this. Let's take a look at this.
My epiphany or breakthrough to provide abortions came about while listening to a sermon by Dr. Martin Luther King. In that sermon, he described what made the Good Samaritan good. And in substance, what made that person good was to ask, what will happen to this person if I don't stop to help? So I became more concerned about what happens to my patients when abortion care is not available than what might happen to me for providing the care, even though I knew that many people who shared my Christian identity wouldn't agree with my decision to do so. There needs to be the deconstruction of what I call the false equivalency of the whole pro-life, pro-choice rhetoric. That's a misnomer. There's pro-abortion and anti-abortion. People who are anti-abortion are pro-fetus, but that often leads them to be against the lives of women. To be pro-abortion, which I am, is not abortion should happen because it is a good thing. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's a biologic reality. But I am for women having access to the services that they need. So we'll have to reframe the conversation to have an honest disagreement, which means that we'll have to deal with facts. People who oppose abortion say life begins at conception. That's a non-biologic understanding, because when we look at how pregnancy occurs, conception occurs when a sperm meets an egg. You can't have a live pregnancy if you don't have a live sperm meeting a live egg. And so if the sperm's alive and the egg's alive, that means that life begins before conception. Life is a process and not an event. You can't answer religious questions with scientific answers. You can't answer scientific questions with religious answers. I think Dr. King said it best, that science gives mankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives mankind wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies.
All right. There's several things in there that we could draw out. But the thing I really want to draw out is this. He's confused something. He said this. He said, if sperm is alive and eggs are alive, that means that life begins before conception. Now, this is a very, very popular argument that those on the other side are peddling everywhere today. This is really gaining traction. This idea that, well, sperm is alive and eggs are alive, so life really begins before conception. So conception can't be a big deal. Fertilization can't be a big line of demarcation, right? Here's the problem. He's confusing parts with wholes. Sperm and eggs are parts of other human beings. Like, let's use you as an illustration. The sperm and the egg that came together to make you belong to your parents, right? They were parts of your parents. When they came to be, you came to be. It's true that sperm is alive. He's right. I mean, this is not a dumb man. This is not a stupid. He's a doctor. Okay? It's true that sperm is alive, and it's true that eggs or ovum is alive, but they're not alive as living organisms. They're alive as individual cells, like skin cells, or you get a haircut. Okay? You haven't committed mass murder when you get a haircut. And the reason you haven't is because those are individual cells that belong to you, but they're not you. Okay? We are living organisms. Sperm is not a living organism. Egg is not a living organism. So this sounds really compelling, especially when it comes from the lips of a doctor who's very articulate, but he's just dead wrong. Nobody in the scientific community that knows what they're talking about believes this. Okay? This is just junk science, right? Now, I want to deal with a few objections here to what I've shared so far, three of them to be precise. The first one is twinning. You might hear this argument, okay? The argument of twinning goes like this. Well, because an embryo, at least in the case of monozygotic twinning, where you have one egg, okay? In the case of monozygotic twinning, because one embryo can split or twin and become two, then you clearly didn't have a person to begin with. So at least in those very earlier stages of development, abortion would be morally acceptable. Now, again, most women wouldn't know that they're even pregnant for several weeks, but this might justify, well, it would justify emergency contraception, morning after pills, RU46, things like that. Okay? But now here's the problem with this argument. All right? Just because one human being can split or twin and become two doesn't mean that you didn't have one to begin with. Think of it this way. There's a particular breed or species of worm called a flatworm, where if you cut the flatworm in half, the head half grows a new tail, the tail half grows a new head, you have two flatworms. Does it follow that you didn't have one to begin with? Well, of course not. Or let's even bring this closer to home. Let's use you as an illustration. If I were to ask for a show of hands, I'm sure there's a handful of you anyway in here who are twins, but let's just say this. theoretically, every one of you could still become a twin, theoretically, through cloning. Cloning is an artificial means of twinning, where we take the ovum of a woman, we remove the nucleus, the DNA from it, we replace it with some of your donor cells, let's say, we give it an electrical shock, a little impulse, and we shock it into life. We create an identical version of you, a twin of you, okay? So identical twins would probably take exception to me saying it's an identical version of you, but you know what I mean, an identical twin of you, all right? Now, does it follow that because we twinned you through the artificial means of cloning, which, by the way, is just, that's a mean of twinning. It means it's a man-made version of twinning, okay? Produces the same result. Would it follow that if we cloned you and created a twin of yourself that you weren't you to begin with? Well, of course not. So again, when you peel the onion back a layer or two, you just see how these things sort of at first blush, you go, wow, that's, yeah, boy, that makes sense. How could one person become two persons? We don't understand it scientifically. In fact, it gets even weirder. Did you know that one person can become a two and then two can become one again? In other words, it's possible you were a twin and then you became one again. Or you had a twin and your twin died in utero before your mother ever knew she was pregnant. Okay, this is all a mystery. But what we do know is that every abortion kills at least one human being. Well, in the case of twins, then two human beings, all right? But the idea that because one embryo can split and become another doesn't mean for a minute that you didn't have a human being to begin with. Let's look at a second one, and I want to do these kind of quickly here. The second one is a thought experiment called, the Burning Research Lab. This is a thought experiment that goes like this, and you will hear this on university campuses occasionally, or in other circles as well. And this is probably not one that most of you are going to encounter, but just knowing how to respond to it will help you sharpen your sword. So that's why I've put this in here tonight, okay? It's a thought experiment that goes like this. You are in an IVF lab, an in vitro fertilization lab, and a fire breaks out. And you're the only adult in the room. And there's a toddler there, let's say a little girl, and then there's a vial over here on this shelf with 10 frozen embryos in it. And so your opponent puts this challenge to you and says, all right, what are you going to do? A fire breaks out. You're in a moral dilemma. You've got to save the toddler, or you've got to save the 10 frozen embryos. Which one are you going to save? Now, how many of you would say, I would save the toddler? Raise your hand. Don't worry, you're not going to get picked on or embarrassed, I promise you. Okay, you would save the toddler. Looks like a good number, if not half or more of you, okay, would choose the toddler. All right. Regardless of how you voted, if you didn't vote, I assume you would choose, I hope you would at least choose the embryos. You wouldn't just say, I'm not saving anybody, right? Okay, so fairly divided room on this. Now, there's room to debate this. There's room to say, well, I would choose the toddler over the embryos, and here's why, or I would choose the embryos over the toddler, and here's why. But here's the point. How does choosing to save one human being over another mean that the one you left behind wasn't a human being or a person? Okay? Let's illustrate it this way. I have five children. Four of them are grown out of the house, but our youngest daughter, Catherine, is at home. She's 18. And let's say that we were in here on a Sunday morning, packed house, and a fire broke out here in this church building. Okay? If I have to choose between Catherine and all of you, I got bad news, folks. You're toast. Now, you might not like that I've made that decision, that I've chosen my daughter over you, but you recognize that parents have moral duties to their own children that they don't have to strangers, right? Okay? But now let me ask you this. Suppose on the way out of the sanctuary, as I'm carrying my daughter out to safety through the flames and through the smoke, suppose on the way out, I slit your throats on the way out. Am I justified in doing that? Of course not. Isn't that a better illustration of what abortion does? Because again, abortion, the debate over abortion is not about choosing whom we're going to save. It's about whom we're going to deliberately kill to benefit us. And that's why this burning research lab just doesn't make any sense. In war, in triage, a squadron is attacked and several of them are killed and others are brought into the medic's tent and they've got arms and legs, limbs missing, and they're bleeding out. And we're the medics and we've got only so much resource, human resources and almost, you know, so much blood. There's only so much we can do. We're going to let some of those soldiers die, aren't we? We're not going to like it. It's a horrible position to be in. But we recognize that we've got to do what we can do. All right? Leaving one behind or 10 behind doesn't mean that the one or the ones you left behind weren't human. This is a silly argument. All right, here's another one. This one is very, very popular. You've all encountered it, probably multiple times, some of you. And it goes like this. Well, the early embryo doesn't look like we do, so we can justify killing it. Now, maybe people don't always say it quite that clearly, but it's sort of implied in a lot of the debating and a lot of the arguments that you find yourself in with pro-choice people, okay? So I want to show you again a short video. This is Melissa Harris Perry, formerly of MSNBC. I'm sure many of you know who that is. She was an anchor for MSNBC. And you got the impression, if you ever watched the show, that the only reason she existed on TV was to defend abortion. She was so radically, such a radical supporter of abortion, okay? So I'm going to show you a short video here. Take a look at this, and you'll see all kinds of stuff wrong with this, too. Can you guys make that one happen up there? Because it's not happening down here for me.
Well, and part of that was because it went a step too far, right? So on our uterus model, Nancy, you know, they have a little fertilized... Oh no, that might be bad. I seem to have popped open the fertilized egg. That's, we'll put that back together.
I think you're okay.
Right. But the very idea that this would constitute a person, right? And that some set of constitutional rights should come to this. Look. I get that that is a particular kind of faith claim. It's not associated with science. But the reality is that if this turns into a person, right, there are economic consequences, right? The cost to raise a child, $10,000 a year, up to $20,000 a year, when you're talking about what it actually costs to have this thing turn into a human. Why not allow women to make the best choices that we can with as many resources and options instead of trying to come in and regulate this process?
All right, just shout out real loud, especially if you're in the back. What's wrong with this? What did you see in this? So, real loud. Money, yeah. She's putting a price tag on human value. She says it costs $10,000 to $20,000 a year to raise a child. Yeah, like if you're sending them to Harvard preschool. I mean, I raised 5 kids, and if it would have cost $10,000 to $20,000, I'd be living in a van down by the river. Okay, this is ridiculous. But let's just take her reasoning to its logical conclusion. What if it costs $100,000 a year to raise a kid? Would that be a justification for killing toddlers? Of course not. We do this thing at Life Training Institute, and other groups do this as well, where when somebody argues for abortion, they put forth an argument for abortion. You ask yourself, would that argument work? Would that be a good argument to justify killing toddlers? If it wouldn't, what are they assuming about the nature of the unborn child? That it's not a human being. How do I know that? Because they would never argue that way to justify killing toddlers. So when somebody says, well, I personally oppose abortion, I would never have one, but I think parents or mothers, women ought to have a right to make those private decisions on their own. Trot out a toddler. Don't panic. Don't get defensive. Just trot out an imaginary toddler. I've got a little girl here. She's 2 years old. Her mother would like the right in the privacy of her home to kill her. Are you okay with that? Now, what's my opponent going to say? No way. And I'm going to respond by, my response is going to be, well, why not? And my opponent's response is going to be, because it's a human being. And my response, that's the question, isn't it? So if we can show that the unborn is human like the toddler, then we're no more justified in killing the unborn than we would be the toddler for those reasons. So don't panic. Just trot out an imaginary toddler. You can do it with almost any pro-choice, so-called pro-choice argument that somebody puts to you. Okay? So I want to stay here for a minute on this third objection. Well, because the embryo doesn't look like us in that earlier stage of development, we can justify abortion, all right? So let's I'm going to show you some photos here, okay? This is a photograph of a single-cell zygote. That's a little girl or a little boy at the earliest stage of development. Now, let me ask you, does anybody in here look at that and say, yeah, that looks like a human being to me? Any takers? Okay? How about this? This is about 6-7 week old. Does that look like a human being? Anybody? A few hands going up. Okay, yeah, it's starting to look like a human being. But let's be honest, if you're single, would you go on a date with somebody who looked like that? My wife did. She married him. All right? Let's face it. If somebody that weighed, say, 150 to 200 pounds showed up at this church on a Sunday morning and sat next to you in the pew that anatomically looked exactly like that, you would think we'd been invaded by aliens, right? So when we say it looks like a human being, it's starting to look like us, but it's still pretty weird. Amen? Okay? How about this one? By the way, I'm not trying to talk you out of your answer. All right? How about this one? Does that look like a human being? We have a consensus? Okay? How about this? Debatable. Too many tattoos. Okay. So what we have here, I don't mean to be juvenile with this, but this makes a very important point, a very profound point. We have 4 human beings at 4 different stages of development. Now, if you didn't know better, you do, but if you didn't know better, you would think that these were 4 different species, because not one of them looks anything like the other 3, right? But what we see here, we have 4 human beings at 4 different stages of development. The old man with the tattoos is not more human because he's older than the little girl on the bottom left. And the little girl on the bottom left there with the stack of books in her hand is not more human than the one above her that looks like a blob. They're equally human, just at different stages of their development. Now, I had a high school student say to me one time when he saw the picture of the zygote, he said, but that's what a chimpanzee looks like at that stage of development. And I said, thank you. That's my point. That's exactly my point. You see, my point is some of us maybe look like chimpanzees at 40 years old. Nobody in this room. But that doesn't mean they are chimpanzees. That's the point I'm trying to make. So let's look at one last picture. Now, I don't want to give you any time to think this one through. You can't cheat off your neighbor on this one. I just want you to react to it. Give me a yes or a no as soon as it comes up on the screen. Does this look like a human being? Okay, I'm hearing several people saying no. It actually does. That looks like a human being. Remember the question, I didn't ask you, is it a human being? I said, does it look like a human being? Now, here's the point. The top left single cell zygote photo does not look like a human being, but she is, or he is. We don't know the gender, but the gender is already decided at that point. Okay, it is a little girl or a little boy. So just because someone doesn't look like a human being doesn't mean that she isn't. So too, just because something like the ventriloquist dummy does look like a human being doesn't mean that it is. And here's the takeaway. We do not define human beings scientifically based on appearances. Nor should we value human beings based on appearances. Do you see what's happening with the abortion debate? This is just another form of bigotry. We are recycling old discriminations. We're holding something against people because of what they look like, or because they're small, or because they're located somewhere else. We're repeating history. That's why I said at the outset, this is not just another issue, any more than slavery was just another issue in 1860. This is the defining moral issue of our day. This is our Goliath as the body of Christ. This is the Goliath that is taunting the church in America. And like the Israelite army, they have cowered in the corner while our little brothers and sisters, some from our own churches, are dying without so much as a whimper from many of their pulpits. This is not just another issue. This is the defining moral issue of our day. All right, I want to turn another corner, and you can take a break from writing here. I already made these points, but let me say these. The question, again, isn't what a being looks like, but what it actually is, okay? And then secondly, our world has a long history of defining people right out of existence simply because they don't look like us, all right? So let me move on. I want to turn a very important corner. You won't be taking any notes at this point, I don't think, but I want to talk about making abortion unthinkable. In other words, changing our culture, the culture in our own local churches. I realize not everybody here is from this church, but changing the culture within our own local churches, but also changing the culture out there. So let's talk for a few minutes, a few really important minutes here about making abortion unthinkable in people's minds. Making it illegal is huge. We need to do that because that helps in making it unthinkable. But right now, I just want to talk about making abortion unthinkable. The problem that you and I have as pro-life ambassadors in this culture is that most people see abortion abstractly, okay? When they hear the word abortion, they're not hearing what you and I are hearing. What they're hearing is, oh, that's that political issue that the political parties are duking it out across the aisle over. Or, oh, that's the procedure where some tissue is removed. What they're not hearing is, oh, that's that procedure where a little girl or a little boy will be dismembered, disemboweled, decapitated, or burned from his or her mother's womb. They're not hearing that. For the vast majority of our culture, even in our churches, the vast majority of professing Christians see abortion as just another issue. It's abstract to them. I was one of those guys. I shared my story at the outset. It was easy to defend abortion or think abortion was okay or at least a necessary evil when I didn't have to see it. Isn't it interesting that in our culture we can see every evil thing under the sun? But we can't see what abortion does to children. Isn't that interesting? Imagine being a professor at a university where you are given the job to teach on the Holocaust, but you are given these instructions. We want you to teach on the Holocaust, Professor Joe, but we don't want you to show any victim imagery. We don't want any bodies, Jewish bodies, stacked on carts or shoveled into the ovens of Auschwitz. None of that. It's upsetting. People don't like it. It might trigger them. So we're not going to do that. As a professor, what would you think? How effective do you think you would be in teaching on the Holocaust if you could never see it? Or how about this? Suppose you were a high school teacher and you were teaching high school students about 911. But you weren't allowed by the administration to show the video footage of those planes going into our buildings. Do you think the students would be moved without seeing it? Well, of course not. Because nothing has the ability to awaken moral intuitions in us like an image. A picture paints 1,000 words. And that's precisely why the Apostle Paul, writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, said this in Ephesians 5:11, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. That's the role of the church. That is the role of the church, is to expose evil and injustice. Isaiah 58, verse 6, or 56, verse 8, I'm not sure, but you can check that out. But in Isaiah, it talks about the fact that that loosening the chains of injustice is the work that we've been called to. In fact, it's the fasting that pleases God, according to that passage. So I think you know where this is going. I'm going to show you what abortion does to its victims. I'm going to show you a video. It's less than a minute long. You will not see an abortion being performed, but you are going to see the aftermath of abortion in all three trimesters, because abortion is legal in the state of Michigan and in all the other 49 states through all 9 months of pregnancy because of the way Doe versus Bolton defined the health of a mother. I'll get into that maybe later during the Q&A. But the point is that this is legal through all 9 months of pregnancy. Greg Cunningham is the director for the Center for Bioethical Reform in Canada, or I'm sorry, in California. And I love this quote by him. He said this: almost everyone knows intuitively that abortion is evil, but almost no one knows how evil it is until they see it, because abortion is unspeakably evil. I'm not necessarily showing the video tonight to convince you that abortion is evil. I'm guessing you're already convinced, and that's why you're here tonight. I'm showing it to you, rather, because I think our heart needs to break for what Christ's heart breaks for. And that's why I'm showing it to you. I want to say this. You don't have to watch this. You can easily opt out of this portion of my talk by simply averting your gaze, closing your eyes. There's no audio narration. And so if you choose not to watch, you're not going to hear anything defined, okay? It is less than a minute long, but I want to warn you, it is difficult to watch. One more thing. Again, as I said at the outset, I realize that I'm speaking to some tonight, I'm sure, who have had abortions or have been part of abortion decisions, been responsible for those. I want to tell you what you hear, at least in this church, if this is your home church, every Sunday. And that is that there is no sin so great, including the sin of abortion, but that God's grace is not greater still. 1 John 1:9 is very, very clear that if we confess our sin, He, Jesus, is faithful and just to forgive us our sin and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Do you know that Jesus doesn't just promise to forgive you of the sin of abortion or any sin? He promises to put you back together emotionally. Philippians talks about the sanctifying work that Christ begins in us and carries it on to the day of completion. So if you're here tonight and you've had an abortion and you've not found forgiveness, don't leave without talking to Pastor Bob or maybe the person who brought you or me. I would love to point you to the scriptures and to point you to real freedom through Christ. Now, with that said, I'm going to show this at this time, and you feel free to avert your gaze if you prefer. But I do want to plead with you. If you've not actually seen it before, I'm pleading with you tonight, if you can stomach it, to watch this. I'm sure many of you are seeing that tonight for the first time. But that is the real face of choice in America. That is what Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry does not want you or your children or your grandchildren to see. That is what the university won't show. That is what the media won't show, and that is what the overwhelming majority of churches in America will not show. And that's why the number keeps going up. The number of babies who die and the numbers of mothers and fathers who are saddled with a lifetime of guilt and regret. You know, we are portrayed in the media, and you know this, and on university campuses and Hollywood films, we are portrayed as Christians, as pro-lifers, as waging a war on women. Nothing could be further from the truth. Easy for them to say that when nobody has to see what abortion does to children. We're not the extremists. They are. I hope you never forget what you saw tonight. We're not the extremists. Speak up for those who have no voice, for all who are destitute. All right, I know I'm throwing a lot at you here, and I know we're moving fast, and that's some heavy stuff here, but we do need to move on. And I want to move to the second question. We've answered the first. What are the preborn? That's the science question. And we've seen that science tells us that from the earliest stages of development, you are a distinct, living, and whole human being. Now, science can only go so far. Science can tell us what something or someone is. This is a human being. This is a computer. This is a giraffe. But what science can't do is speak to the value of a human being. So we've got to go somewhere else for that, and we're going to go to philosophy. Now, if that troubles you, if you're thinking, why is this guy who was a pastor and who's speaking in a church tonight, why isn't he going to the Bible? I'll tell you why. It's not because I'm ashamed of the gospel. Not at all. It's because we have to know how to talk to a secular culture, to speak to people who, frankly, don't care about our Bible. We've got to know how to meet them where they're at. Now, just to be clear, I don't think we stop there. I like to say it this way. I want to meet people where they're at and take them where I want them to go. And, you know, responding biblically to abortion is a gospel issue. It's a loving your neighbor as yourself issue. But when we do this, it leads to a gospel opportunity. I cannot tell you the numbers of time in my work, and I'm sure many of you have similar stories of where, because I've been sharing on a university campus or in a church setting or on an airplane, because I've talked about my work or talked about the preborn, it has opened the door for me to talk about the gospel. So I don't want anybody to misunderstand me here. I do not have a low view of the gospel. I believe God's word is the inspired, infallible, inerrant, authoritative word for our lives. But we want to be able to talk the language of the culture that we're living in. So we're going to appeal to the science or to basic philosophy here, okay, to answer this question. What makes us valuable, right? That's, again, the philosophy question. Are we valuable for what we can do, or are we valuable simply because of the kind of thing that we are? Those are your only two choices. It's one or the other. Are we valuable because of what we can do, or are we valuable simply because of the kind of thing that we are? Those are the only two ways. So let's take a look at this. We're going to look at the pro-life view, and then we're going to contrast it with the so-called pro-choice view, all right? I'm not going to do justice to either one of these views. I'm not pretending to. But I want to give at least a summary, quick flyover of both of these views, all right? Let's start with our view, the pro-life view. This is what pro-life author Christopher Cazor, in his book The Ethics of Abortion, refers to as the endowment view. And I love that, because I think it's really accurate. It's really apropos. This is the view that says our value is rooted in our humanity. This is the doctrine of the Imago Dei, that we are God's image bearers. We're like him in that we are moral beings, rational beings, creative beings, okay? So our value is rooted in our humanity, and we have that in equal measure. Nobody in the room is less human or more human than the other, okay? Regardless of what limitations we may have, what handicaps we may have, all right? So our value is rooted in our humanity. You're not valuable because the crowd says you're valuable. You're not even valuable because you've created your own existential value for yourself. You are valuable simply because of the kind of thing you are, a human being created in the image of God. Now, I'm not suggesting that's a real compelling argument to an atheist. It's not necessarily. But it's still part of our foundation, so we're going to work from there, okay? Secondly, this is the view that is inclusive and tolerant. And I just can't tell you how much fun it is for me to say that. Because you and I are portrayed, again, everywhere in this culture as the haters, waging a war on women, the intolerant ones, the bigots, right? The homophobes. We hate everybody that doesn't look exactly like us. That's what they, you know, that's the narrative, right? Nothing could be farther from the truth. It's our view that says every individual has inherent moral worth simply by virtue of being created in God's image. Black, white, rich, poor, Jew, Gentile, born and unborn. We don't care if you're bisexual, heterosexual, antisexual, quadsexual. We don't care what kind of sexual you are. We love you. This is the message of the gospel, isn't it? We meet people where they're at. Okay? Who's the tolerant ones? We are. Who's inclusive? We are. You just watched with your own eyes, most of you, that video, and you saw what abortion does to children. Is that a picture of inclusivity? No, that's a picture of elitism. That is a picture of discrimination. We're the tolerant ones. Don't forget this. Thirdly, this is the view that says our identity remains the same throughout time and change. In other words, you're the same person now as you were then. I've kind of made this point earlier, but I want to hammer this a little bit more here. Our identity remains the same throughout time and change. So if you're 30 years old, 50 years old, 70 years old, however old you are here today, you're the same being now as you were then in your mother's womb. I don't mean you look the same. I don't mean your value system's the same. Your IQ is the same. I don't mean your functional abilities are the same. None of that. That's all changed. But you're the same being, the same person as you were then. Okay? So I want to illustrate this with a story. Some of you maybe will, I'm guessing most of you won't know the name, but you will know him when you see him because he's semi-famous. Samuel Alexander Armus was 21 weeks of gestation in his mother's womb. His mother's name was Julie. His dad's name was Alex. And it was discovered through prenatal testing that he had a condition called spina bifida. And the doctor said to Julie, to his mother, "Mom, if you'll let us perform surgery on you, we can go through your abdomen into your uterus, and we can perform surgery on your son, and we can substantially correct this problem, this condition of spina bifida." Well, of course, Mom granted permission, and on the day of the surgery, not only was the surgical team there, but they had also invited in a professional photographer who snapped some stunning photos. And the photo that I'm going to show you made it into USA Today in 1999. And everybody was talking about it. Now, if you've got a really weak stomach, close your eyes. Because what you're going to see is this mother's abdomen opened up, a small incision, and you're going to see little Samuel's arm flopping out, and he's touching the surgeon's glove. And there he is. Isn't that a cool photo? You see the creative genius of God. You know, the life in the womb and life out of the womb touching it. It's so sweet. Now, it's funny because when this appeared in USA Today in 1999, the left went nuts. The pro-choice crowd went crazy. They hated it. And there was, in fact, if you go to Scopes, there's a big article about how it wasn't really true that he was grabbing the surgeon's glove. Well, I don't doubt that that wasn't true. The mother was under anesthesia. He was too. I don't know that he was reaching out and touching the mother's glove, but they missed the point. I don't care if he's doing somersaults or not doing somersaults. The point is there's somebody in there. And that's why people were amazed by the photo. Now, I'm amazed by it. I'm guessing you're amazed by it because, again, we see the creative genius of God at play here. But I think for a lot of people in 1999, this was a whole different thing for them. They were amazed, but for a different reason. For them, this was an aha moment. Like, oh, my goodness, Harold, look, there's somebody in there. Yeah, it's called pregnancy. There is somebody in there. That's the point. Now, I'm going to fast forward the clock of little Samuel's life by 10 years and show you another picture. Here he is. You recognize that left arm? You've seen it before. Same kid, right? Same kid. He's changed in all kinds of ways. He's more independent. His location has changed, okay? He was swimming in utero. Now he's swimming in a pool, all right? But he's getting swimming ribbons for it now. I mean, we can assume that his IQ has changed, his values have changed, his personality has changed. One thing's remained the same. What is it? Everybody's mumbling. Same person. His identity, yes. His identity is the same. So then doesn't it follow that if Samuel Alexander Armus at 10 years old, now he's 19 now, is that right? I'm not real good with math. 19 years old now or something like that. But in this photo, 10 years old, doesn't it follow that if he's an intrinsically valuable human being at 10 years old, deserving legal protection, who should not have a crosshairs put on his chest, doesn't it follow then that he has always been and always will be an intrinsically valuable human being? Because his nature doesn't change. You see, if your nature doesn't change, then your value can't change unless you believe that people are only valuable based on what they can do, which is precisely the pro-choice position. Now, I don't think all pro-choice people know that or realize what they're believing, but that's what they believe. They believe that people are valuable based on certain accidental properties that they acquire throughout time, properties that are not essential to their nature, okay? But we don't believe that. As Christians, we don't think that we're human doings. We think we're human beings, that the simple fact that we exist created in God's image is what gives us value. We're not human doings, we're human beings. All right, let me move on. This position, our position, the pro-life position, provides the only unshakable, true grounding for human equality. The minute you divide the room or the womb based on subjectively chosen, arbitrarily chosen so-called tests or standards to determine who lives and who dies, you have destroyed the foundation for human equality. I mean, imagine if I said this. I'm committed to human equality. I run around and brag, I'm committed to human equality, except for blacks. I think they're subhuman. I'm committed to human equality, except for women. I don't think they're as smart as men. How's that sound? Can I really boast of my commitment to human equality the minute I say accept this group or accept that group? How about this? I'm committed to human equality except for people located on that side of the birth canal. You see, the minute I've done that, I've destroyed any foundation for human equality. You cannot parse or dissect human equality and have anything left of it at the end of the day. It is an all or nothing proposition. I want to say more about that when we turn a corner, which we're going to do right now. Now, again, this is not intended to be an exhaustive handling of our view, but that's some of the foundation of our position, okay? And we can defend that all day long, can't we? Right? Okay, let's look at the competing worldview, the so-called pro-choice view. What Christopher Cazor rightly refers to as the performance view. Oh, let me back up, by the way, because I didn't say this. When Christopher Cazor referred to our view as the endowment view, he said that because he believes, like I think you believe, that we have been endowed with certain value. And our founding fathers understood that when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, right? That we've been endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, most notably the right to life. Okay, so now Christopher Cazor refers to the so-called pro-choice view as the performance view. Now, that would be highly offensive to pro-choice people, but it's fair. This is not inflammatory rhetoric. This is completely accurate because this is the view that says only certain human beings should be accorded personhood status or respect, and only if they measure up to some standard, some test that the powerful have established for the weak. Okay, so here's what this view does. You know that if you're 35, 40 years old or older, you know that it used to be that 20, 30 years ago, when people would defend abortion, they would do it like this. Well, it's not a baby. It's a blob of tissue. It's a product of conception. It's a mass of unwanted cells, right? Some even crassly refer to the unborn child as a parasite in order to dehumanize them so we could justify abortion, right? But very few people argue that way anymore. Some do, but very few. Now the argument goes like this. You know what, Mike? You're right. It's a girl, it's a boy, it's alive, it's a human being, it's growing, it's developing. I'll grant you all of that. But it's not a fill in the blank. Say it loud. It's not a person. Okay? So what they do is they divorce humanness from personhood. Now, just let's be clear about this. This is sleight of hand trickery. This is smoke and mirrors. When you say that there's a difference between a human being and a person, there is no difference. If you're a human, you're a person. Now, we would argue as Christians that you can be a person without being a human. We would talk about the personhood of the Holy Spirit, or we would talk about angels. Angels are not humans, all right? But if you're a human, you are a person. You have personhood. It has nothing to do with any accidental property that you acquire, okay? It's simply by the nature of you being a human being, all right? Now, here's an example of what this looks like. There's a million varieties of this, but here's one. Peter Singer, who I quoted earlier, the radical defender of abortion and infanticide, said this. He said, human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping that they exist over time. They are not persons. Now, you remember the earlier quote I showed you? He acknowledged the humanity of the unborn child. But here he denies the personhood of the unborn child. He said, they are not persons. Then he goes on to say this. The life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. Now, to be fair, I don't think most pro-choice people think this way. And I don't put that up there to unfairly lump them all together. But I will tell you, on every university and high school campus that I go to throughout the United States, this view is gaining traction everywhere. This is not some nut off in a corner. His book, Practical Ethics, is the gold standard secular university campuses, anyway, for ethics. Now, you see what he did there. Somebody tell us, what is the standard test that he thinks ought to determine whether or not you live or you die? What is it? Self-awareness. He says it right there. So here's what you want to say to him. And we're going to get into some specific arguments here as we bring this to close. But here's what you want to say to your opponent when they bring this kind of thing up. And by the way, they might say brainwaves, heartbeat, sentience, self-awareness, wantedness, normalcy, viability. There are dozens of these, right? But when somebody, let's use his as a working illustration. So when Peter says this to us, you should say, well, Peter, how'd you come up with that? How'd you come up with self-awareness? And if self-awareness is such a compelling, value-giving test for determining who lives and who dies, how come you can't even convince the people on your side of the issue to agree with you? They're all over the map. There's no consensus. One person says it's heartbeat. Next pro-choicer says it's brainwaves. You guys can't even agree. Right? Here's another thing you want to say to Peter. Pete, how much self-awareness? I wasn't self-aware at 3 o'clock this morning. Anybody here had surgery? You went under anesthesia, right? You were not self-aware. Can we kill you then? Now, he would argue that once you have self-awareness, if you lose it, you're still valuable. My response would be, why? I thought you said self-awareness was value-giving. Now you've lost it and you're still valuable? That doesn't make any sense. This is what's called the episodic problem, where there are episodes in our life where we are more aware or not aware at all, or you know, more self-aware than other times. And those times come and go in our lives. That can't be the thing that serves as the foundation for human equality. Plus, if it is, then you want to ask Peter this. Hey, Pete, who's going to decide for every individual baby in every individual womb whether or not that baby is self-aware or not? You can't just say, well, self-awareness comes at so many weeks. By the way, self-awareness doesn't come. It's debatable. But at least a couple of months after birth. And by the way, if you notice that quote, he's not defending abortion. He's defending infanticide, isn't he? Right? How much self-awareness? Who decides? Are we going to have a panel that's going to measure the self-awareness on every individual child? You see, this is Pandora's box. The lid's just blown off. And that's exactly the mess we're in as a culture today. All right. This is the view, the pro-choice, so-called pro-choice view. As I already said, there's no consensus on which standard should determine who's worthy of life. Let's move on. This is the view that annihilates human equality. I told you I wanted to come back to this issue of human equality, okay? This is just another form of bigotry. Again, I don't think I'm being unfair. Because the minute you divide the room or the womb based on subjectively chosen, arbitrarily chosen standards or tests to determine who lives and who dies, you have effectively destroyed any foundation for human equality. I mean, it seems really simple to me. Mary Elizabeth Williams is a radical defender of abortion, and she wrote in Salon magazine back in 2013 an article. And by the way, the article was titled, let me see here, I want to look this up, I want to make sure I get this title right. She titled it, quote, "So What If Abortion Ends Life?" And in the article, she referred to the preborn child as a life worth sacrificing. But listen to what she said here, what she admits here. She said, here's the complicated reality in which we live. All life is not equal. A fetus can be a human life without having the same rights as the woman in whose body it resides. She's the boss. Her life and what is right for her circumstances and her health should automatically trump the rights of the non-autonomous entity inside of her always. My response? Who says? Who are you to say? Who are you to decide for every other human being that this person's rights trump this person's rights? She does not deny the humanity or the personhood of the unborn child. She'll grant both of those. And she says we still can grant the right to a legal abortion because of what she argues for bodily autonomy or bodily rights, which basically is where somebody says, look, I agree it's a human and I agree it's a person, and I think the person inside the womb even has a right to life. But the mother's right still trumps that right. And so we can still abort them. So easy come, easy go. You got a right to life, but it's worthless because mom can take it from you at any time. Now, I want to illustrate this. In, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, my son-in-law is a young man by the name of Seth Dreher. And Seth is one of these guys. He is so incredibly likable that even his enemies hate the fact that they like him so much. He just ruins their day because he's Winnie the Pooh with a spine. Okay? I mean, he really is. And he's just a sharp mind, razor sharp mind, cast iron spine, gentle demeanor. He's the whole deal, okay? And he had his first public debate, moderated formal debate, at DePaul University about 3 or 4 years ago, I forget, in Indiana. And he was debating a professor on the campus by the name of Dr. Jeff Klinger. And this was a tiered seating room. About 200 students showed up that night for this in this little mini auditorium. And as I understood it that night, as I sized it up, it was a fairly divided room. You know, half or so of the students were there supporting my son-in-law, Seth, in his pro-life position. And the other half was there supporting Dr. Jeff Klinger in his so-called pro-choice position. And as you know, as these debates go, there's an opportunity to cross-examine your opponent, right? So when Seth has the opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Jeff Klinger, he asks him a question that every fifth grader in America should be able to answer without thinking. Here was the question. Dr. Jeff Klinger, do you believe in human equality? Here's how he answered. He shrugged his shoulders, hung his head, chuckled to himself, and at the amusement of many of his supporting students in the audience, he said, occasionally. That's not funny. You see, when you say you believe in human equality only occasionally, what you're saying is you don't believe in it at all. Not at all.
That is the same worldview that brought us the ovens of Auschwitz. That is the same worldview that put blacks in leg irons and on the back of the bus in our own land. That's not funny. And what a scandal that we have high school or college students on university campuses laughing at that. God help us. God help the church. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that pro-choice people supported slavery or that they support the Holocaust. That's not my point at all. My point is this, though, that the same worldview, the same evil, pathetic, corrosive worldview that gave us the ovens of Auschwitz has given us the dumpsters behind abortion clinics in America. It's the same worldview that says certain people matter and certain people don't, and it's the powerful who get to decide for the weak who lives and who dies. Let me show you another quote that you will like much, much better. This is Christopher Cazor, who I've quoted now or referred to a couple of times in his book, The Ethics of Abortion. He said, "A vision of personhood that rests on the arbitrary decisions of the powerful against the weak cannot be in conformity with the demands of justice or equality." Amen. That is a great statement. All right, I want to turn another corner here. We're still kind of on the second point, but we've addressed two questions. What are the preborn and what makes this valuable? So as we bring this second point to a close, and we'll turn one final corner here tonight where we get into very specific arguments that the other side shares, and I'll show you how to respond to some of those. I want to point out that there are only four differences between the adult that you are today or the young person that you are today and the embryo that you once were. And not one of these differences justifies killing you in the earlier stage of your development. Now, this comes in the form of an acronym, the word SLED. This was developed by a pro-life author by the name of Stephen Schwartz. This is super handy, super effective. You will want to use this. The S, L, E, and D here in the SLED acronym stand for these four differences. Now, I want to be clear. These are real differences, and I'm not denying that. But they're not morally significant differences such that we can appeal to one or more of them to justify killing you at any stage of your development. Okay? Certainly not in that earlier stage of your development. So let's take a look at these. The first one is size. You know, we hear from the other side, well, the baby is so small. That's, in essence, what Melissa Harris Perry was arguing on that video clip I showed you. You know, she's holding up the little embryo model that looks like a marble, and she's basically saying, look, this, you know, we're going to give constitutional rights to this thing, right? Remember that? Because it doesn't look like us, because it's so small, okay? Well, when your opponent says this, when he or she argues for abortion appealing to somebody's size, your response should be something like this. Well, yeah, sure. You know, embryos are smaller than newborns or adults, but the question is, why is that relevant? Size doesn't equal value. Men are generally larger than women, but we don't give men greater rights for that reason, nor do we use that as a justification to kill women. Now, this is not a silver bullet argument. I know some of you might be sitting there going, oh my goodness, if I use that in my psychology class, they're going to laugh me out of the room. Not so quick. You're right. They're going to say to you, they're going to look at you cross-eyed and say, what are you, crazy? That's not my point. Your response? Then what is your point? You're the one, not me, who's appealing to someone's size to determine whether they should live or die. Okay? How about the L? The L in the SLED acronym stands for level of development. Again, we hear these arguments all the time. Well, the baby has spina bifida, or it's got Down syndrome, or it's not viable, okay, yet until 23, 24 weeks, whatever. And so we hear these arguments, these level of development arguments, okay? But the response is, well, you know what? 4-year-old girls are less developed than 14-year-old girls. For instance, 4-year-old girls do not have a fully functioning reproductive system. Does that justify killing the 4-year-old girls? Well, of course not. Now, what's my opponent going to say? Oh, Mike, come on. That's not my point. My response? What is your point? You see, you're the one, not me, that's appealing to someone's level of development to determine whether or not they should live or die. Look, if you and I have to reach a magical level of development that some panel or Congress or some court decides for us, then my 18-year-old daughter, Catherine, doesn't count. This is our youngest. We have 4 daughters, 1 son. Catherine's our youngest. Catherine's 18 years old. She was born with cerebral palsy. She cannot walk. She has very limited use of her right hand and virtually no use of her left hand. Okay? At 18 years old, Catherine has the mentality level of about a 4-year-old. She is severely mentally and physically handicapped. Now, if you have to measure up, Catherine doesn't measure up, and so Barb and I may kill her. How's that sound? To anybody with an operating conscience, rather repugnant, yes? Isn't this ironic, though, that in this culture, when Barb and I take Catherine to a mall, a restaurant, a ball game, anywhere out in public, perfect strangers are opening the door for this little girl. Why? Because they see need. They see vulnerability. And the greater the vulnerability, the greater sense of responsibility that we feel, right? Perfect strangers are opening door for her. Because God has placed in all of us a moral intuition that wells up when we see this. Even atheists, they won't admit where it comes from. But they've got it too. Now, isn't this ironic that on this side of the birth canal, we give Catherine extra love? We've got wheelchair ramps, automatic door openers. You've got them on the church here. I noticed that when I came in. But on the other side of the birth canal, in many, many wombs in America, she would have a crosshairs put on her chest and would be snuffed out for the same reason we open doors for her on this side of the birth canal. We have lost our minds as a culture. She's the same kid. She's an intrinsically valuable human being at 18 years old, despite her limitations. And she has always been and always will be a valuable human being. All right, let's move on. The E stands for environment in the SLED acronym. Size, level of development, and E, environment or location. You were in the womb, and now you're out of the womb. Big deal. Where you are doesn't determine what you are. How could an 8-inch journey down the birth canal magically transform you from a mere human to a person deserving legal protection? It's just a change of address. Now, it's more than that for the women who give birth. Moms, forgive me, okay? But for the baby, it's a change of location. We don't kill people based on where they're located. If you're a restless sleeper, you rolled over in bed last night. Guess what rolled over with you? Your identity, your nature. You didn't stop being you when you walked into this auditorium a couple of hours ago, an hour and a half ago. You're the same person now as you were then, okay? How about the D? The D stands for degree of dependency. We hear these arguments from the other side. Well, the baby's dependent upon its mother. It couldn't live out of the womb until 23, 24 weeks. This kind of an argument. By the way, let me tackle something here very quickly before I expound on that. Because we will hear the viability argument brought up again at this kind of a point, degree of dependency. And when Roe v. Wade was established and Doe versus Bolton in 1973, viability was about 24 to 28 weeks. In other words, a baby could live with proper postnatal care if it was born as early as 24 to 28 weeks. But over these last 40-plus years, our medical technology has advanced, and so now babies can live much earlier, 23, 24 weeks, okay? Some have lived as early as 21 or 22 weeks, although very, very rarely does that happen. Now, we hear this argument from the other side. Well, I think abortion ought to be legal through viability, which usually is a smokescreen. Usually what they mean is abortion ought to be legal through all 9 months of pregnancy, but that's the thing they cling to, so it sounds sort of civilized to say that I don't support late-term abortions, okay? Just remember this, viability doesn't describe children. It describes medical technology. And Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court justice, actually admitted that Roe v. Wade was on a collision course with itself because of medical technology. As it advances, that line moves further and further back. Theoretically, it's hard to imagine this, but theoretically, we could push Roe v. Wade and viability all the way back to conception, where babies could live in artificial wombs and so forth, okay? So remember, think of it this way. If a woman is pregnant and she's 28 weeks along, her baby is 28 weeks of development in her, so well past the state of viability here in the Detroit area where you have good hospitals, Beaumont, Henry Ford, so forth, right? But let's say she gets on a plane and she travels, she's 33, 34,000 feet in the air, and she lands in Guinea, West Africa, where they have virtually no postnatal care, no neonatal intensive care unit, no NIC unit, okay? Well, now the baby's not viable. It couldn't live outside of its mother's womb, even at 28 weeks. So according to pro-choicers who cling to viability to establish the personhood of the unborn child, what they're saying is you're a valuable person, not just a human, but a person here in the Detroit area, but in Guinea, you're just a human. So that means you went from being a human to being a person to being a human. She gets back on the plane and comes back, guess what? Her baby's a person again. You see a problem with this? Please say yes. Yeah, this is the problem the other side has. They have no unshakable foundation. We do. We do. All right. If degree of dependency is the magical standard, you've got to reach a certain level of independence before you're considered worthy of legal protection or worthy of the church's defense, then these girls don't count. Brittany and Abigail Hensel, conjoined twins from Minnesota. I don't know how old they are. I think they're 21, 22 years old now. They are school teachers. They just accepted a position in the last year or so, I think, as school teachers. But they are conjoined twins. Fascinating young ladies. If you've never seen them, go to YouTube. There's all kinds of videos. They drive a car. I mean, they're fascinating. But they are dependent on each other for absolutely everything, vital bodily organs. They could not be separated because they are so dependent upon each other. In fact, they were interviewed. One interview I watched, they were asked, if you could be surgically separated, would you want to be? You know what their answer was? No. We love our lives. Now, whether they love their lives or not isn't my point. If they were miserable, that wouldn't be justification for killing them. Okay? My point is that degree of dependency is not a reason to kill innocent human beings. Now, if we suggested, you know, I talked about trot out a toddler, let's trot out conjoined twins. Should we kill Brittany and Abigail Hensel for the reason that we kill unborn children because they're dependent upon each other? What's your opponent going to say? Well, no, I wouldn't want that. Your response, why not? Why not? I thought it was degree of dependency that made people valuable or not valuable. Again, I don't think I have to beat the horse to death here. You guys get the point, right? Okay, let's move on. I want to turn a final corner now here, and I want to talk for about 20 minutes. I want to show you the five mistakes that the other side makes when they defend abortion. They don't necessarily make these mistakes on purpose. Some of them, I think, are deceitful. The overwhelming majority, I think, are not. They're just confused, and they haven't thought it through very well. Okay, so I'm not trying to vilify anybody here with this. All right, we're assuming the best, perhaps, of their motives, at least generally speaking. But I'm going to show you five mistakes that they make, and then I'm going to illustrate each one with some of the arguments that they will use when making this mistake. All right, let's start with the first one here. Oftentimes, pro-choice advocates will confuse objective claims with subjective claims. Now, if that's confusing to you, it's not. I'll make it real simple. It's very easy. An objective claim would be a moral claim that's true for everyone, everywhere, at all times. So let me give you an example. Raping women is wrong. That's not just a personal preference claim. That's a moral claim that I'm making. And again, nobody with an operating conscience would disagree with that. Even evil men who do rape women generally know that what they're doing is wrong. Not always, but generally they know that what they're doing is wrong. Okay? Now, that's a moral claim, true for everybody, everywhere, at all times. A subjective claim would be Mike Spencer likes vanilla ice cream, which happens to be true. Okay? But that's not necessarily true for you. You might hate vanilla. You might have an allergy to vanilla ice cream, okay? So it's true for me, but it's not necessarily true for you. Now, to be clear, raping women is wrong, and Mike Spencer likes vanilla ice cream are equally true statements. One's not more true than the other, but they're true in different ways. One's a moral claim, one's a personal preference claim. Here's how the other side oftentimes confuses the issue. You've seen this bumper sticker. Don't like abortion? Don't have one. This is precisely what I'm talking about. They have misunderstood the kind of claim that we're making. Look, when we as pro-lifers oppose abortion, we don't do it because we don't happen to like it. We oppose abortion because we believe it unjustly ends the life of an innocent human being, and that is wrong. Okay? It's not about personal preferences, about what we like and what we don't like. It's about what is morally right. That's the kind of claim we're making, okay? So when they say don't like abortion, don't have one, they are confusing this and putting this on the level of a personal preference claim. Now, if that's not clear to you, I've got three. That's a bumper sticker. I'm sure most of you have seen that. It's a pretty popular bumper sticker. I'm going to show you three more bumper stickers. These are not real. Don't panic, okay? I made these up. Although the first one I'm going to show you, I've been tempted to have printed and put it on my bumper because it would be fun to watch people in my rearview mirror. But I want you to imagine you're driving through Roseville, you come to a red light, I'm in front of you, and on my bumper is this bumper sticker. Don't like jelly donuts? Don't eat one. You would be scratching your head and going, man, what's this dude all uptight about his jelly donut? Eat your doggone jelly donut, I don't care. Right? That's weird. It's a weird bumper sticker, right? Okay? You see what's going on here? This is what they're doing. Don't like abortion? Don't have one. Don't like jelly donuts? Don't eat one. Same thing in their minds. Okay, now if that's still not clear, then I'm worried for you. Okay, but if it's still not clear, here's another one. Don't like torturing puppies? Don't torture one. Look, what my wife and I want to do with our basset hounds in the privacy of our home, that's our business, isn't it? Can't we still be friends? How about this? Don't like abusing children? Don't abuse one. What do you care what my wife and I do with our children? Can't we still get together and barbecue on Saturday? Do you see what's going on here? Remember, the first bumper sticker, don't like abortion, don't have one. You've seen with your own eyes tonight what abortion does to unborn children. That is the ultimate child abuse. So when somebody has in their car, don't like abortion, don't have one, they might as well have this one on. Don't like abusing children, don't abuse one. Especially given the fact that abortion is the ultimate child abuse where it kills children. Okay, this is an example of confusing an objective claim with a subjective claim. Here's another one. They will oftentimes attack the person rather than refuting the argument. Anybody know what that's called? What's the Latin term for that? An ad hominem, yes. An ad hominem attack against the man or against the person, okay? Now, to be fair, we've all done this. I think I'm safe in indicting all of you with me. We've all done this. We've all, you know, somebody's put an argument forth and we weren't prepared for it and we had our back against the wall and our pride came out kicking and screaming and we said, well, your mother's ugly and she wears cowboy boots or whatever, you know, combat boots, whatever. Okay, so we've all done this. So again, I'm not trying to vilify our opponent here, but I will be honest, this is epidemic on the other side. Because quite frankly, they don't have very many good arguments. In fact, they don't have any good arguments for justifying abortion, all right? So here's an example of this. I'm going to show you a short video. In fact, let me set it up. This is Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, the former big-time wrestling guy. And it's 2 minutes long or so. And turn your baloney detector all the way down to 1.6. That's all you're going to need for this one, okay? But you'll see what's wrong with this. But basically what you're going to see here is an ad hominem attack. He's going to attack you rather than attack our argument. Okay, here it is.
What angers me about the pro, and I don't call them pro-lifers anymore, I call them pro-birthers. Because here's why. Here's what angers me. They all want to outlaw abortion, and then all these kids come into the world, and yet the same people take away welfare, and they take away the very safety net that many of these unwanted children are going to need to survive. So they give birth, and then they say, well, you're on your own now. Well, what's the odds of these unwanted children becoming successful? I'd say slim to none. So if you're anti-abortion, then you should be pro-welfare. Because somebody's going to have to take care, in many cases, not every child is born into your perfect Leave It to Beaver family. You know, people get pregnant. But my belief unequivocally is it's a woman's right to choose. Because that woman has to give birth to that child, and that woman has to raise that child. Now, men play a role too, but women play a larger one. In that, and it's certainly their choice to make. And banning Planned Parenthood or stopping money for that is ridiculous, because if you're anti-abortion, you should be pro-contraception. But yet they're not, are they? And you should be.
All right, I love the fact that he's their spokesperson and not ours. And what an appropriate shirt he's wearing. Did you notice it? All right. So again, there's all kinds of stuff wrong with this, but here's a trap that is being laid for you as a pro-life advocate. Your tendency is going to be, if it's like mine, my tendency is when somebody comes out swinging like this against us, you want to defend the pro-life community. You want to say, that's not true. Pro-lifers do care about babies once they're born. And you want to launch into a 45-minute defense of the pro-life community. Don't do it. Do not take the bait. This is a red herring. It's intended to take you away from the main question. The main question is, what are the preborn? Because as Greg Kokel said, if they are human, there's no justification for it. Okay? So this is the main question we want to stay focused on. Don't get dragged off into the weeds here. Now, there's nothing wrong with defending the character of pro-lifers. I do it all the time. Somebody says this to me, I'm going to say, look, do you know, Jesse, that there are actually 560 or so surgical abortion clinics in the United States that are run not exclusively, but primarily by men for financial profit off of women in crisis. Contrast that with about 2,700 to 3,000 pregnancy care centers that are run primarily by women, for women in crisis at no cost to those women. Who's the friend of women? So I'll defend the character of pro-lifers all day long, but I'm not going to let him do that to me. If I'm going to give a defense, I'm going to make it real quick, and I'm going to say, now, Jesse, let's just assume something here. I'm willing to grant you your premise. I'm willing to grant you that pro-lifers don't care about babies once they're born. We want to take welfare away from all of them. We couldn't care less if they starved to death after they're born. Let's assume you're right. How is that an argument for abortion? How does the alleged hypocrisy of the pro-life community, how does that justify dismembering, disemboweling, and decapitating little girls and boys? Even if we're all hypocrites, that doesn't make abortion good. You see how pathetic this argument is? Okay, here's another one. You're a man. You don't have a right to speak to the issue. I get this on occasion, and it always feels good. Because I've got the body of a fifth grade girl, and I like when people tell me I'm a man. Tell my wife that, please. I'm a man. Okay? Guys, don't be intimidated by this. Francis Beckwith, a great pro-life apologist, says it this way: arguments don't have genders, people do. In other words, my arguments against abortion are good arguments or they're bad arguments, but it has nothing to do with my gender. We have women on our staff at Life Training Institute who do the same thing that I do. You've got to contend with my arguments. You can't just dismiss me because you don't happen to like my gender. This young man showed up at a university in Florida. I don't know how many of you can see that in the back. It's a little bit small, but he showed up with he was a pro-choice guy. He showed up with a little marker board, and on it it says, "No uterus, no opinion." Anybody see a problem with this? He's got an opinion, but I don't think he has a uterus. He might. This is a weird world. Okay? But he's got an opinion. Now, interestingly, nobody on the other side goes up to him and says, "Hey, you're a man. You don't have a right to your opinion. Put that sign away." No, they like his opinion, so he gets to speak. Which tells us that the real issue is not that they don't like my gender. It's that they don't like my position. This is an ad hominem. This is an attack against the person. You have to contend with the arguments. You can't just dismiss me because you don't happen to like my anatomy. So guys, when you hear, "Well, this is a women's rights issue." By the way, this is why a lot of pastors don't give attention to this. Because most pastors are men. And most pastors, or I can't say that this is true for most pastors, many pastors have been intimidated into silence because they think, "Well, it's a women's issue. I'm a man." It's not a women's issue. Slaughtering children in the name of choice is a human rights issue. And I, as a man, have as much right to speak to this as any other human being, as any woman. So guys, don't be led astray on that. Okay, let me move to the third one here. They will oftentimes assume the very thing that they need to prove. By the way, again, this is called begging the question. And this is, without question, the most common mistake that they make when they argue for abortion. And by the way, I'll just insert here quickly. Most so-called pro-choice arguments are not arguments. They're slogans. They're cliches. An argument is a certain kind of thing. It's a premise, and a conclusion. Don't like abortion, don't have one, is not an argument. Every child will want a child is not an argument. Okay? So most of them are slogans, cliches. I'm going to use the word argument because, again, this is easy to refer to them that way. But so oftentimes they will assume the very thing that they need to prove. All right? So what they need to prove is that the unborn child is not a human being, and therefore we can justify killing them. Or they need to show us why there really is a difference between a person and a human. Again, something they can't do. All right? So here's an example of this. My body, my choice. You've all heard this. It's probably been their most useful slogan over the last 45 years. My body, my choice. Now, what's the assumption being made about the unborn child? Anybody, shout it out good and loud. The baby is part of the body, that the baby is not a human being on its own or not its own person, right? Now, again, you've got to argue for that. You can't merely assert it. I mean, they do this all day long. But this is where, as a pro-life ambassador, you should be saying, "Well, now, what do you mean by that? Help me understand that. Do you mean to tell me that if you were pregnant with a little one, that you have four arms, four legs, and if you've got a little boy, you've got male parts? Is that what you're arguing? Do you mean to tell me that you're willing to go against the entire science of human embryology to make this case?" You see, draw them out with questions. Just put the onus of proof back on them by asking good questions, gently but directly, and staying focused on the nature of the unborn child. All right, this is just one example. Here's another one. It's not right to bring... I just heard this yesterday at a university in Ohio. It's not right to bring children into the world where they will be abused or neglected. Now, I'm sure you all do this. When we're in a debate or a dialogue with somebody that we disagree with, we try to find common ground. And we can find common ground with people who support legalized child killing. We're not going to find common ground on that issue per se, but there are other issues. We can say, "Well, yeah, the foster care system's a mess. I agree with you there." Or, "Yes, I do think that women are on the losing end of relationships in America most often." There's a lot of common ground. Here's a great example of this. I happen to agree. I do not think we should bring children into the world who are going to be abused or neglected. That's the worst thing to do. We should never do it. The problem is, when a woman is pregnant with a baby, that baby's already in the world. That baby's already been brought into the world. You see, they've made an assumption, haven't they, about that child, that the child's either not a human being, or it's not a person, or it's not in the world. That's the assumption they're making. In fact, I literally heard it probably three or four times yesterday. Look, if you drove here in a Volkswagen, you were in the Volkswagen, in the world. It's not like you're driving down the road in Volkswagen going, "Wow, I'm having an out-of-world experience." No, you're in the Volkswagen, in the world. If you were in your mother's womb, you were in your mother's womb, in the world. It's just a location. Okay? So the assumption here being made, again, is that they're seeing the unborn child differently than they're seeing the born child. And that's where, again, you want to go back to the science of human embryology and the basic philosophy using SLED, size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency to keep drawing them back out. All right, let's move on. A fourth one. They will oftentimes confuse human value with human function. We already saw this, Peter Singer talked about self-awareness. That would be one example. Melissa Harris-Perry also did it in her video, okay, where they will base human value on somebody's abilities or their functional abilities. The philosophical word for this is it's called functionalism. Functionalism, okay? Now, here would be a great example of this. Ellen Barkin, the actress, back in 2014, tweeted this. And by the way, it was kind of comical when she did it because she came under great fire for it. She said, newsflash, a fetus cannot talk. It is not a person, not even a baby, not even an infant. Nope, sorry. You see what she's doing here? She's saying that your value as a human being is based on whether or not you can talk. How many of you came out of the womb speaking sentences? Now, I don't know if she realized it, and it is admittedly a little unclear the point she's trying to make, but at the very least, she's defending abortion, and at the very most, she's actually defending infanticide here. Okay? Now, remember, Peter Singer said it's self-awareness. She said it's the ability to talk. Okay? Do you see what's going on here? No consensus on the other side. They can't even agree. All right? Here's another one. Oh, I got to go back. I don't want you to see that until I set it up. How many of you know the name Joseph Sobrand? He was a conservative columnist who died several years ago. Anybody remember that name? Okay, a few of you. He was a great writer and a great defender of the unborn, pro-life guy, good guy, okay? But he was, in an article that he wrote many, many years ago, I cut this out probably 15 years ago. I don't even know when he passed away, many years ago. But anyways, in this article, what you're going to see him do, and again, this is a good guy. He's a pro-life guy, okay? But what you're going to see him do is he philosophically picks the pockets of our opponents in order to defend the pro-life side. And I'll bet you $1.80, half the people in this room have done it. I used to do it, okay? We won't ask anybody to confess tonight. But look at what he does here. Here's what he says. After tens of millions of abortion procedures, has America lost anything? Another Edison, perhaps, a Gershwin, a Babe Ruth, a Duke Ellington. As it is, we will never know what abortion has cost us all. What's he doing? What's he doing wrong? Say it nice and loud. Exactly. He's saying that abortion is a bad thing because of not what it costs the unborn child, but because of what it costs us. Now, it's not an altogether bad question to ask. It's a fair question. We've all wondered. I wonder what abortion has cost us as a culture. Maybe we did abort the person who would have found a cure for cancer or AIDS or whatever. That's a fair question. Here's the problem, though. He's on real thin ice. Because you know what his opponent's going to say to him on a university campus or in your workplace? He's going to say, yeah, but we might abort. You're saying we might abort the next Gershwin, the next Babe Ruth. That's a bad thing. But I'm saying we might abort the next Pol Pot, the next Hitler. And that would be a good thing, wouldn't it? You see what's going on here? Don't do this. Abortion is not bad because we might abort the next Einstein or the next Gershwin. Abortion is bad because we might abort the next child with Down syndrome. And that's tragedy enough because we believe every human being matters. Right? That's our position. So don't do this. Don't philosophically pick the pockets of our opponents to make our position. All right? Last one, and then we'll go to Q&A. Our opponents will oftentimes disguise their true position by hiding behind hard cases. Now, to be clear, the true position is that generally, not always, what their real position is that they support abortion, every abortion, through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason. No apologies, okay? That's typically the real position. But they'll hide behind the hard cases, like rape, incest, life of the mother, these kinds of things. So let's take the rape challenge here for a minute. I think I've got a... So let's take this one. Again, I told you at the outset I was going to come back to this. So this is probably the challenge that when it's put to us as pro-lifers, we all, or at least many of us maybe in the room, start to get a little nervous, like, oh, I hope they don't ask that challenge, right? Because we are oftentimes made to look bad, especially the men in the room who don't even grant a rape exception, okay? Who would not grant a rape exception. So here's how I would encourage you to handle this question. When somebody says to you, and maybe it's a pro-lifer who really does think abortion's bad, but they're not quite sure what to think about rape, okay? Or maybe It's an opponent who doesn't care about rape, doesn't care about rape victims, isn't pro-life at all. They're just trying to trap you and make you look bad. Either way, here's a two-part response. The first thing you want to do is identify and acknowledge the difficulty of the challenge. So here's how I do it. You're going to obviously do it different. You'll see why. But when I get this question on high school, university campuses, I will say, what's your name? Cindy. Cindy, thanks for the question. I appreciate it. You're asking a really tough challenge here. You're raising a tough challenge. Because you're right. Women and young girls do get raped, and they do conceive children against their will. Cindy, I'm married to a woman. I have 4 daughters and 3 granddaughters, and I cannot imagine one of my loved ones being raped and conceiving a child against her will. That would be a horrific position to be in. Now, have I answered the question to that point? No. What have I done? Yeah, I've identified with the questioner. Going back to Ravi Zacharias' maxim, never answer a question, always answer a questioner. So we don't want to do what a lot of pro-lifers do, where they say, oh, that's less than 1%. That's not very helpful if you're the 1%. If you're the 13-year-old girl carrying some rapist's baby, that's not very helpful at all, is it? So don't do that. Start out by saying, you know what, you raise a fair challenge. I can't imagine it. And say something along the lines of, then say this. But Cindy, isn't the real question, how should a civilized society treat innocent members of society who happen to remind us of a painful event? Should we kill them? Should we kill them? Again, here's the question. How should a civilized society treat innocent members of society who remind us of a painful event? Should we kill them? And the answer is no. Look, the reason we as Christians oppose abortion, even in the case of rape, is because it doesn't matter how one was conceived. The question is, was one conceived? I don't know most of you in this room. I don't know how you were conceived. I'm not stupid. Your mom and dad had a sexual relationship, and poof, here you are. But what I mean is, I don't know the circumstances under which any of you were conceived. Maybe you were conceived in love by parents who loved each other. Maybe you were conceived in marriage by parents who fought all the time. Maybe you were conceived out of wedlock, or maybe you were conceived through the violent act of rape. You know what? It doesn't matter. Because your nature is not altered based on the circumstances in which you came into being. So we should not give the death penalty to innocent human beings for the crimes of the guilty, the rapist. The Supreme Court has ruled we can't even give the death penalty to rapists except under certain circumstances, and yet we give it to the innocent child.